From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, an opportunity for a little commentary and analysis and maybe even some insight into the media issues of the week. Good day to you all. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. There he is.
My pleasure, Rex.
And also, did not mean to suggest that that was sarcastic at all, of course. And also, here is Kaylin Brown, head of the journalism program at the College of St. Rose, and Judy Patrick, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, now off getting her blood pressure lower in a different kind of a job.
That's right. Work for the New York Press Association, working with newspapers all over the state.
And it's less stressful to work with newspapers than newspaper people.
For some reason, it is.
Yeah, amazing thing. Well, you know, that daily constant pressure of journalism is something that drives people to stay in the newsroom, but it also can drive people to
be crazy.
Early grave. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say that for those people who are listening who haven't been keeping track, we're going to rename this show the Three Against One Show. Me trying to raise some of the legitimate issues that people may have with the press, and the three of you agreeing with each other, patting each other on the shoulder, and talking about how inviolate anything that the press does is. So I want everybody to listen today to this program, and you'll hear it.
And you'll hear Alan Shartok is part of the problem because he's mixing it up and dissing us. You need to stop dissing the press and support it.
No matter what.
Okay, here we go. What about news deserts? I mean, it's a great term. We've talked for some years now about food deserts, people who live usually in urban areas or far off in the country where they can't get wholesome, good produce and the like, where their only alternative for food is to go to bodegas. Now, news deserts, new data coming out that will show that at least 900 communities across the nation have gone dry since 2004. That is, no access to local news coverage. What are we going to do about that?
Well, Rex, there are a whole bunch of people who will tell you that social media substitutes now for the press. I don't believe that. The other thing about news deserts are that there are many towns in this country, there are many places that only have one source. And if that source is corrupted, then you have maybe not a news desert, but you have a news monopoly, which can be equally as dangerous.
Right. You know, there is this phenomenon also known as phantom newspapers, for example. That is, they carry the label, the flag of a former newspaper, but they're actually shoppers. Or they are, as you were saying, Alan, like little mini Breitbarts, something like that. They just have a partisan twist to them. It's really tough because we know that the economics of it are such that it's hard to sustain a journalism organization in a small community.
And I want to say one other thing, and I'm sure we'll get some reaction in that, is one word, Sinclair.
Well, what if I avoid Sinclair? But we could. It's hurting its affiliates. You know, they're touting the Trump organization's bottom line and reading corporate manifestos on the air. But still, what about new models for journalism? What about foundations and not-for-profit organizations that might underwrite journalism in locations where there are news deserts? I think new models would be valuable.
You know, the downside is that every once in a while, you get a revolution. For example, not-for-profits owning a newspaper. Now let's just say, or a group of well-meaning people owning a newspaper. I've always believed in Robert Michel's The Iron Law of Oligarchy, which means you put five people in a room and somebody becomes the dictator. And so what happens is, even though you may have a not-for-profit, which is one of the reasons we have such a strict wall between the newsroom here at Public Radio and me as the head of the station. Otherwise, one guy is running the whole thing. And if that guy is either corrupt or bad news, then that's a whole other story.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I've learned in this new job I have is that there are thousands of newspapers still out there functioning, but it's undeniable that thousands have closed and that thousands and thousands of journalists have left the field. And just by the sheer volume, it has to have an impact. Town boards aren't being covered. Village boards aren't being covered. You're seeing some development of media, of web-only news sites, but it's not nearly enough to compensate for the loss of the print publications.
Well, you know what's interesting, Judy, is one of the things I love to watch on television, on TV, as we say, is that I watch the town board, the town selectman meeting.
Fascinating. Oh, boy.
And then I
riveting.
And then I watch
you have an exciting
and then they
life.
Have the Board of Education.
Oh.
And you know, they have all of these other things. I have a friend named Bonnie. Bonnie's now the head of the Southern Berkshire Regional School District. She's the chair. And I always kid her and say it's the Bonnie Silver Show. But if you want to, you can get an awful lot of news without having somebody to interpret it for you.
Well, that sounds like George W. Bush. I like to get my news straight rather than have it somebody. Yeah, the fact is, it's actually useful to have reporters, you know, Alan. That may be an amazing notion to you, but it is
that's
true.
So condescending of you, Rick.
Reporters actually have the capacity to draw on their archives, to draw on their knowledge, their expertise, to bring some analysis to the news and not just factual recounting.
You know, that's so interesting because you're always the one who's arguing. Maybe I'm contentious because I've just come through yet another fund drive, but you're the one who's always arguing, aren't you, that we just report the news, we give it to you straight, and now you say, well, one of the things about that 23-year-old who we're putting up in that meeting is that they're going to give you their analysis of what's important, and that sounds to me like opinion.
It's more of a synthesis, I think. I was that 23-year-old many moons ago at school board meetings, and I remember very clearly being the person who was there to be the eyes and ears of the individuals who couldn't be there. I remember being at a Scaticoke Village meeting and then a school board meeting at Hoosick Valley and waiting out for 4 hours outside when they closed the meeting against the law to, you know, have some personnel discussion. But we reported it all. And then we involve Bob Freeman in it. But either way, the point is there are 23-year-olds and 25-year-olds who can be there and distill for the readership what happened at that meeting. Because most humans can't spend 4 hours sitting at a meeting. They have mouths to feed, jobs to go to. They're expecting journalism to be there and to do the work and tell the story.
There's no reason to be so defensive about it.
Stop attacking us.
You know, the difficulty is that, of course, there isn't, because in the economics of this, there are no young reporters covering the Scaticoke Village Board anymore. We haven't been to the Hoosick Valley School Board in many years. You know, we dip in when we can, but our newsroom, honestly, to tell you the truth, is half the size that it was when you were doing that work for the Times Union. So that's what creates news deserts, right? It's really difficult.
Yeah, but I really was sort of off base on the age because young people can be very good, you know.
Wait, are you wrong? Did you say you were wrong?
Yeah.
Can you say it?
Let this be a moment of self-recognition for us.
Can I make the point that reporters aren't supposed to be stenographers? They don't just go in and provide a transcript in the daily newspaper. They provide context. They provide the wisdom that comes from, they get from their editors and from talking about what's really happening. I've gone through many board meetings where I said, what the heck is going on? Because sometimes they don't even say what the resolution is. I moved to pass resolutions 1 through 30. I second, approved. And then the what the heck is going on?
Hey, Judy, I'm slavishly devoted to you, and you know that.
But.
Like the Nexium people up here, I'm slavishly devoted to you.
That's disturbing.
Which you wouldn't know about if you hadn't read the Times Union, by
yes,
the way.
Well,
for the last 15 years.
I want to point out New York Times did not do that story alone.
I'm slavishly devoted to you. However, I have to say, that's a bunch of malarkey. The fact of the matter is that there'll be some social conservative, for example, who's sitting at home and saying the context, which is set by the person who is the filter, that context, of course, can be misleading in that it gives vent to the people who, yeah.
Well, if you don't care about context, Alan, why do you bother with your morning show where you sit here and talk all morning about your view of the issues? That's context,
well,
isn't
yes,
it?
Well, yes, and then we have Herb London giving a different kind of thing.
Oh, but not Herb London again. We're going to talk about your one conservative commentator.
You think you would
police.
Let me just, you think you'd just let me, you think you'd just let me finish
no,
what I'm
I
saying?
No, I know what you're going to say.
Well, of course you know what I'm going to say, and I know what you're going to say. Nevertheless,
you're going to say it.
It doesn't portend well when we don't let the other person finish their sentence.
Sorry. I was going to let you. But, you know, the great fact is so much has changed. When I was a young guy editing a little tiny newspaper in Rensselaer, Indiana, that little community had for many years had an AM radio station, WRIN, and a little daily newspaper, circulation 3800 in this county seat of 5,000. And then a little FM station came on. An old guy retired from WGN in Chicago and bought the two-room schoolhouse on a bluff and put a radio station in the basement and lived upstairs. So we had two radio stations and a daily newspaper. And then there were a couple of weeklies out in the rural areas covering this little farm belt county in northwestern Indiana. That's a lot of media for this community. And now, of course, radio stations, if they still exist like that, they don't have news departments or their signals have been bought up by regional stations. So that the fact is I had sometimes two other competitors when I would cover a county board meeting from local radio stations and somebody from a weekly. That, I'm sure, doesn't happen there anymore. I'd be surprised if they have even one reporter at most of the county board meetings. That's where we really are running into a problem. That's why we often think about the alienation of voters in this democracy and wonder what gave rise to the anger that brought us Donald Trump. I think some of it is people feeling that they are out of touch, that there's nobody paying attention to their issues. There isn't somebody bringing news to their community.
And you know, you make a very good point, because if those Indiana radio stations had been allowed to persist, maybe Mike Pence wouldn't be the vice president of the United States right now.
Well, these things happen. We would love to hear your thoughts on this. Media at WAMC.org is a way to share your thoughts about this, about news deserts and the many other issues that confront us as the media issues go along. Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith here with you on the Media Project. So we're going to talk about misuse of images here. In this case,
that's a great subject.
Involves Fox News, which had to apologize after they used photos of Philadelphia Eagles players kneeling, giving the impression that they were demonstrating during the national anthem. In fact, the players were praying before games with their teammates, and it was used to illustrate the controversy between the White House and the Philadelphia Eagles over the national anthem, which led the president to cancel his invitation to the Eagles.
So what do you make of it? I mean, what was that really all about, Rex, or anybody?
Well, people can make mistakes when they pick a photograph. When they're in a rush, they grab it. But you would think at that national level, at an important network like Fox News, that they would be more careful and not just grab any photo of any player kneeling. Of course, it was somebody kneeling, but the context is they were kneeling while they were praying, not during the national anthem. And the implication was, I saw the story very quickly and I go, oh my goodness, they did kneel during the national anthem. As a casual observer, that's what I thought.
Now, you know what? One and one makes two. We do know that Fox tends to follow slavishly the president of the United States and what his particular needs are. And so if it were NBC, which, quote, made the mistake, or if it were CNN, which made the mistake, that might be different. But here we see a so-called mistake being made by a slavishly devoted, to use that term again, station. And so therefore, you know, it seems quite clear to me that it was purposeful, or at least it may well have been purposeful.
I think one of the best parts about this whole story about this misuse of the image of the football players was that the Eagles tight end Zach Ertz is the one who tweeted out that Fox had made a mistake. So I think there's value there that perhaps a casual observer, but, you know, a regular watcher of the news saw this and said, that's not right, called them out on it and said, shouldn't there be somebody doing something about this? Like, isn't that problematic? So
Well, there was. And that was him, right?
It was him.
And that's one of the great values of social media, because you can have individuals who actually are the ombudsman for good journalism if they can call them out.
But context, Rex, is so important here.
It is.
I mean, you know, let's face it. There is no question that the base that Trump relies on is, well, I want to use a word, but I'm not so sure you can say everybody in the base is, but a lot of them are racists. And this is a racist move. To show, you know, basically black people either kneeling or not kneeling, for what reason? To talk about the death of black young men. And that's why this whole thing started. Trump finds that very easy. I think Fox finds it very easy, because it once again it's used to inflame the base.
Well, I cannot believe I'm going to say this. To its credit, Fox recognized the error and apologize for the error. So I think we need to note that that happened, because any good journalism, I'm not equating Fox with good journalism.
So you're defending Fox here.
I can't, but we have to acknowledge it, because we would be sinning were we to omit it.
Yeah. But also the damage was done. It's the problem with corrections is the corrections are small and the initial problem persists and gets put in people's heads. People believe that's true.
And you're right. And the impact of the visual is so significant. Now, just to be clear, no players on the Eagles 2017-18 regular season knelt during the anthem. None. So just to be clear, this was actually incorrect. But people associate images and it makes a very powerful impact. I mean, here we are with sound, which also has a great impact on people. But video and visual images have such an effect. The Times Union's design director, Tom Palmer, teaches journalism at UAlbany and has a website that he has developed in connection with that called The Picture Prosecutor. And he catches this. He is a watchdog on the misuse of images. It is widespread. It is almost an infection that is all over the web. People are using images that don't really reflect the news stories, but that give more impact to something. And it could be something as minor as the wrong kind of a tick being used to illustrate Lyme disease, or it could be something major like showing an attack that is not, in fact, from the country being described in the news story.
And it's important to point out, too, that professional photographers, like the ones who work at journalism organizations, generally belong to a trade association for photographers that has a code of ethics. And
well, you guys have a whole code of ethics, and I must say, you adhere to it very closely.
And you know, and one of the people who would traditionally catch that would be a photo editor, and a lot of the newsrooms have lost their photo editors as they had to shrink staff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
But as you point out quite correctly, Professor, no two ways about it. The way you take the picture, what you take the picture of, is quite frequently the message. And I would bet the people who photograph for a Fox or Sinclair might take different pictures than somebody who photographs for the New York Times.
All right, on to another topic. Let's talk a little bit about an economic topic, an editorial in the Berkshire Eagle, the daily newspaper that serves your hometown in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. Alan?
What do you say serves?
It does a good job serving your community, sir. And we're very happy. There's a tough thing going on for newspapers. I don't mean to be self-serving here, but there are new tariffs being imposed. In this case, on newsprint being imported from Canada. They're going to have a tremendous impact. And it is going to cause my newspaper, for example, it's going to cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars more this year because of the rising price of newsprint caused by these tariffs that the president is imposing on Canadian newsprint, all being done at the behest of a little paper company in Washington State. One paper company, North Pacific Paper Company, filed a petition with the Department of Commerce, and now here are these tariffs coming in. A lot of these little papers, we were talking about news deserts earlier.
We're talking about 35%, right? Something like that?
Something like that.
Incredible.
32% surcharge.
Yeah, quite amazing. And, you know, supposedly this is to protect jobs, but the Berkshire Eagle editorial points out that even if every American paper mill ran at full capacity, it could only supply 20% of the nation's newsprint.
It was a good editorial, and I read it. And I think that basically they do a very good job. But it could be seen as self-serving, could it not?
Well, sometimes serving yourself is actually also good citizenship.
Right, because what's going to happen in the end is the readership is going to get hurt. The citizens will be hurt because you're going to see smaller newspapers. Maybe newspapers will publish less frequently. Maybe advertising rates will go up. Maybe circulation costs will go up. People will shrink the size of their newspaper.
Sure.
They'll cut special sections. Real things will have to happen. And as a result, people will get less news.
Yeah.
But individuals who care about the news could contact their Senate leaders and ask them to consider the bill titled the Print Act.
Now, there you go again.
All right.
Which would suspend the print tariffs while some research is done on this tariff.
Okay, but
There's not been any research on any of these tariffs. They were just imposed wholesale by our king.
Well, yes, and that is exactly the point. And I would have to, under great duress, agree with you that this is really a part of the war on the press that Trump has been conducting all along, a war on the press and the First Amendment. And so therefore, you know, one way is to punish the press is to make them, you know, put them under your thumb and say, we're going to take something away from you. Look, this is not the first person I've seen Andrew Cuomo do things like this. I've seen, you know, people do things in order to punish their political enemies. That's what I think is happening here.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, it's kind of you because you could be self-serving here and say, well, I don't care about newsprint. I'm an electronic medium and it doesn't...
Well, I am a columnist for a whole lot of papers, including the Berkshire Eagle, which, as you said, quite properly serves the people of the Berkshires.
Well, there you go.
But, you know, if the president is actually trying to target the media, it's the small newspapers that are really going to get hurt by this. I mean, the big papers that will be able to sustain it, they've developed pretty strong digital sites. I don't think he understands the impact it will have on those community newspapers where they're not writing about the president's
policies.
Well,
the New York Times has had its problems in terms of fiscal stuff. On the other hand, at least they'll be able to go to Carlos Slim for another loan if they need to.
He has sold his interest. By the way, do we care about propaganda? We used to talk about the propaganda of the Soviet state, and now the White House is going to put a conservative ideologue in charge of the government agency that is the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is the nation's largest public diplomacy program, actually, because it runs the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, some of these other entities, reaches an audience of 278 million people in 100 countries, and the president wants to put one of Steve Bannon's allies in charge of that thing. Is it just smart foreign affairs of the United States government to have really powerful propaganda like that?
The word smart in line with the current administration does not compute.
And this is the same administration, Caitlin, that I couldn't agree with you more, is sending an ambassador, first time we've ever seen like something like this, to Germany and injecting himself into the politics of that country. We've never seen anything quite like this before. So the only reason I mention it on the Media Project is that it just shows you how intent they are of injecting their own form of politics into whatever they can.
Well, it will be interesting to see if it is any more factual than what we are getting from the White House. Just the interesting factoid, statistic of the day, the Washington Post fact-checking unit, you know, has been tracking the president's misstatements. So far, it is going at a pace of 6.5 a day. That is more than 200 false or misleading statements a month from the president and the White House. Now, he, of course, would say, well, the Washington Post, what do you expect? They're a bunch of liberal folks who are anti-Trump.
Well, but look in history. Hitler did the same thing. People sat on their hands and they didn't do anything about it. That's the whole thing when a democracy turns into something else, into a totalitarian state. It's awful.
They've been doing this for a while, and previous presidents have been caught not telling the truth. But the difference here is the sheer number. And also, once they would catch a previous president lying, the previous president wouldn't repeat the error, and
right.
They would. But the new president, President Trump, he doesn't care.
So that leads us to the quote of the week that we can close the program with. Donald Trump speaking to Billy Bush. No, we're not going to talk about what you're thinking of. He said, look, you just tell them and they believe it. That's it. You just tell them and they believe it. They just do.
We can't end it with that. We can't end it. We're letting him get the last word.
But
I object.
True.
I object. Read journalism. Listen to journalism. Watch journalism. Real places.
All right. In that, we will bring an end to it with a passionate statement in defense of journalism from Caitlin Brown, Judy Patrick here, Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people.
funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.